It's for the wobblies and the workers, what's up, hello? Let's have a dialogue about private sector pirate laws. The right to work for less is goddess and to fight for jobs. We sign a union card with pride because we're going haywire, this the Haymarket riot mob. Flipping burgers with a bachelor's degree, serving to you on my mask.
Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
Though the precariat is around us at all times, too many people tend to treat them as invisible, and a good documentary or a good dramatic film makes it clear that they're there, they're visible. If you have eyes to see, you will see them, and you will realize how important they are and how neglected they are in terms of their working conditions, their wages, and so forth.
That's Tom Zaniello, author of a number of books about how work is portrayed on film, including my favorite, Working Stiffs, Union Maids, Reds, and Riff Raff, an expanded guide to films about labor. Labor History Today contributor Sherry Lincoln sat down with Tom to discuss his next book, an exploration of media accounts of precarious work, ranging from Edward R. Murrow's famous 1960 documentary, Harvest of Shame, to the storytelling of modern video games. Sherry, the latest addition to the LHT team, is a professor of English at Georgetown University and the editor of the blog Working Class Perspectives. She's also a faculty affiliate of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University, which co-produces Labor History Today. Speaking of which, Kalmanovitz Associate Director Lane Wyndham checks in this week with a quick reminder of the uprising of the 20,000 in 1909. October was LGBTQ History Month, and for this week's Cool Things from the Mini Archive, Chloe Danio digs into the archive's Pride at Work collection and comes up with a historic pamphlet on organizing for lesbian and gay rights in unions.
The streets were thronged with other marchers cheering us along. We yelled out to the crowd, "Are you a union member?" "Yeah," we heard. "What union?" we asked them. And the replies were numerous. "Teamsters, Local 22, ask me. Look, here's my card. Equity, Local 4, teachers, carpenters, Local 124, gays and lesbians in the labor movement. We are everywhere."
All right, here's the show.
"And you can help me. You can't turn me to a robot, but I'm user-friendly. Time to unify, wouldn't you agree? Measure the units of the unions by the unity of you and me. Bang!"
This is Sherry Lincoln, and I'm talking today with film scholar Tom Zaniello. Tom has written several books, including two guides to films, Working Stiffs, Union Maids, Reds, and Riff Raff, a guide to films about labor, and The Cinema of Globalization, a guide to films about the new economic order. His new book, The Cinema of the Precariat, due out early in 2020, combines these themes, looking at films about how economic change is remaking work and labor. Thanks for taking some time to talk with me, Tom.
Thank you. I'm very eager to talk about this project.
I'm so glad. I want to start actually by asking a little more generally about the work that you do. And this is going to sound like a dumb question, but I think it actually isn't. Why is film such a useful tool for understanding economic issues, the meaning of work, how labor works? Why film?
I would say probably the most important reason is that although the precariat, for example, is around us at all times, too many people tend to treat them as invisible, and a good documentary or a good dramatic film makes it clear that they're there, they're visible. If you have eyes to see, you will see them, and you will realize how important they are and how neglected they are in terms of their working conditions, their wages, and so forth. So film takes you to where you should have been looking in the first place, but maybe didn't see enough.
That's a great way to phrase it. You begin to gesture in talking about the importance of film towards my next question, which is really just to talk a little bit about what you mean by the precariat. I think we've been starting to hear this term be thrown around a bit, but I'm not sure people always know what it means. So how do you define it?
Well, I defined it as a class of workers, usually in terms of traditional class analysis categories, a one cut or one rung below traditional proletarian or workers or unionized workers. The crucial difference between the two classes is that many unionized and other kind of workers retain not only extensive legal protections, but also in some cases a significant series of rights and important additions to their work, such as health care and so forth. The precariat has nothing, literally has nothing but the wages they are paid usually at the end of the day in cash. They have no protections in terms of job longevity, any kind of health or welfare are not possible. Often this class, not exclusively, but in many cases, are undocumented. So the employers, whether consciously or not, take advantage of that fact and can say to them on Monday, you know, I don't really need you tomorrow, Tuesday. Sorry about that. I'll see you next week. And there's absolutely nothing they can do it. So the precariat is literally precarious in all categories, income, job access. I like to say, if I sat out on my porch here in Washington, D.C., I see two sets of workers going by me all day long. I see mailmen, I see policemen, I see firemen, I see sanitation workers. They're all relatively protected in their jobs. They're good jobs in terms of income, but they also have the protection of unions or social structures. I look around again. Who else do I see? I see nannies walking down the block. I see construction workers rebuilding an old house. I see maid services going to buildings near me. This class of people is the precariat. And it couldn't be more obvious once, as I say, once you concentrate on some of the characteristics of the two groups, it becomes obvious who the precariat is.
That makes a lot of sense. Your description of it, and just thinking about the jobs you cite, makes it sound like the precariat is more likely than the working class to be immigrants, certainly, but also to be female. So is the precariat gendered?
No, I think the jobs they hold are gendered, meaning nannies, domestic workers, hotel workers are female. Mostly male are construction workers. And when you get into the restaurant and hotel business, they're fairly equally distributed, meaning that women occupy various jobs as maids, waitresses, and kitchen help, and the men also are occupied in those jobs as well. So there are certain labor arenas in which there are as many precarious jobs for men as there are for women. But there are certain occupations in which women dominate.
So I think people have started talking about precarity and the precariat relatively recently. This term, I think, has been coined pretty recently. But one of the things I found really interesting in looking at your book is that you remind us that the conditions of precarity, and therefore a class that we might call the precariat, isn't actually that new a thing. You actually begin the book by taking us back to films from the middle of the 20th century. You talk about Edward R. Murrow's documentary, Harvest of Shame. Why was that such an important project?
The Harvest of Shame chapter of my book, I take as the central historical linchpin of the study I'm trying to do. Because it turned out that all through the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and certainly into the 60s, these migrant laborers, and they were both from often Mexico, but in the most many, many cases, they were American-born and not Mexican-born. And they did literally all the farm work across the country in any large farms. Individual farmers, which to a certain extent, a farmer and his individual farm is an American ideal, but the vast majority of foodstuffs were picked by migratory labor, all of whom had held precarious jobs. We didn't know the term then, but certainly Edward R. Murrow spotted them and made Harvest of Shame. He was followed by at least 8 or 10 television documentaries doing what we might call follow-up documentaries, looking at the ethnic Latino workers, looking at the traditional African-American migrant workers, and of course always including the dwindling but still present white migratory workers. So they were there, just that they were literally invisible and kept invisible because, as Edward R. Murrow said, these are the people, these are the workers who create the best-fed nation in the world, but at a cost.
Yeah, so part of what Murrow did is really reveal some of that cost. For people who haven't seen that documentary and don't know about the follow-up, how would you describe that film? What did he do?
He essentially went to the out-of-the-way places. Some of the names are familiar to us now, but like Immokalee, Florida, where crew bosses would round up and secure 10, 20, 30 workers, put them in a truck, and head out to one of these large farms. And what Edward R. Murrow had to do, of course, was to find some workers and some families of workers, because often these families traveled together, both the women and children worked as well. The children did not go to school as a rule. They worked in the fields with their family. He tried to find families and individuals who would talk on camera. This was not easy because, of course, either instinctively or because they heard through the grapevine that if their employers, if their crew leaders heard that they were speaking to what we now call the media, they would lose their jobs. And that's often what happened. In fact, in one of the follow-up films, the director specifically tried to find 10 years later the same workers and families that Edward R. Murrow had himself interviewed. He found three, and all three at first agreed, and by the time the interview was about to happen, they all reneged and said, there's no way they can do that. They'll just lose their jobs immediately. So he was on the ground in remote areas of the country before anybody else had the sense to do that.
And the follow-up films, you mentioned one that goes to try to track down the same people. But some of them, as I understand it, they were going out to see if things had changed. Did they find changes over time?
No. As a rule, they found no changes at all. I mean, the crews, if you were lucky enough to get on a crew, that guaranteed you most of the time a day's wages. It did not guarantee you continuous employment. You were constantly competing with other people at the shape-up sites. So to a certain extent, for the next, Edward R. Murrow's film appeared in 1960, for the next 10 to 20 years, there really was no major change. In fact, not really until the Grape Growers Organization did what we might call mass successes at breaking the stranglehold of the big farms take place. There were some organizing efforts run out of the AFL-CIO after Edward R. Murrow's, but they weren't supported enough, and they didn't have any breakthroughs. And we soon there was Farm Labor's Organizing Committee, FLOC, which had some successes. But as a rule, it was only the grape pickers that had some breakthroughs. And most of those, as you probably know, were lost later anyway.
So, Tom, are people still making films about migrant workers now? I mean, we're 60 years later, but we're still, migrant work continues to be a key part of precarious labor. Are we still seeing films, and what do the newer ones look like?
Well, yes, one of the biggest categories in my book is migratory labor. Now, I do take a worldwide view of it, but we still see in a number of documentaries American migrant workers fighting for jobs and having some of the same problems. I would recommend a film called Food Chains, which puts the emphasis on the fact that it's the national food chains that, to a certain extent, literally controls the price of every tomato picked. And believe me, they do everything they can to keep it pretty low. So Food Chains would be a good documentary to follow up on this topic. I've done a fair amount of looking at the border, what I call the border films, obviously mostly Mexicans who have crossed the border, usually illegally, but not always, and some of the special problems they have in trying to survive. Unfortunately, some of them have been, some of the conditions are terrible because the women especially are vulnerable to abuse and assault because these are essentially unregulated, unpoliced, unsupervised work gangs. And the women have to basically survive as best they can. There's also a tendency in some of the border towns in the United States and Mexico to allow the local police, who sometimes are good, sometimes not, to make the decision about whether to investigate a particular abusive situation. There's one particularly disturbing and I think very important documentary called Señorita Extraviada, which looks at the role of the civil authorities and women who are, in some cases, literally disappeared. It's a horrible situation and is way overdue for a remedy.
So you are talking mostly at this point about, you know, films that are kind of focusing along the U.S.-Mexico border. But as you say, precarity and the precariat, this is really a global phenomenon. If people want to get a sense of how precarity works globally, are there films that you would tell us to start with to get a just to get a sense of what's going on in other places?
Yes, I'd begin with the director, Ken Loach, who's probably better known in England than here, than he should be here, but he really is the director of precarity in England. He has two relatively recent films that deal with the precariat trying to survive in British cities. One's called I, Daniel Blake, which had a very brief run here in the United States, and a new film, Sorry, We Missed You. Daniel Blake is about a carpenter who loses his job and tries to survive in the social work network. And Sorry, We Miss You is especially relevant since I think almost every person I know has a package left on their porch, if not every day, at least once a week. Sorry, We Missed You is about a franchise delivery system in London in which the workers, the drivers, are so-called self-employed by these delivery companies who take contracts from various, including Amazon, to deliver these goods. And, of course, the goal is always to deliver the goods within 24 hours or 36 hours if possible. So the pressure on these workers is immense. Sorry, We Missed You, of course, is the note that they put on the door if they haven't been able to deliver the package. But these guys, and almost always guys, but there's some women, work terrible hours under terrible pressure, and they have to either rent or purchase their own vehicles. They're given X number of packages in the morning and say, get it done in 6 hours or we won't hire you the next day. So those are two I think I might begin with. Your British films, I, Daniel Blake, and Sorry, We Missed You.
I want I want to interrupt for just a second because I want to follow up a little bit on these two films. Part of what I think is interesting about these is, in part because they focus in Britain and focus mostly on white characters, I suspect that they feel like things that you know, to be stereotypical, your average middle-class American can identify with because they're not that far away. That they are about the forms of precarity that we all either experience regularly or can imagine getting to be part of. Does that seem right to you?
Yes.
It's part of what makes them accessible films?
Yes. And what Ken Loach is expert at is perceiving and filming. These are fiction films, but of seeing how a man can have a job one day and then literally fall off a traditional working class job into the precariat through no fault of his own necessarily. And the scramble to survive in the precariat is that much harder than the average working class job. So he's a master at spotting that drop from one class to the other.
Right. So are there, to go along with that or to complement those, are there films that will take, you know, American viewers further afield into parts of the world and into experiences of precarity that are less familiar to us, things that we really might not, you know, I loved what you said at the beginning of our conversation about the way film shows us things that might otherwise not be visible to us. So are there films you'd recommend that take us to places that we might not encounter?
Yes, I would say the second or third largest category of films I have are about Chinese workers. The Chinese system of precariat labor is somewhat different than ours. In any case, what has happened in China is that internal migration, not cross-border migration, but internal migration from rural and small cities to larger cities and industrial complexes has dominated over the last 10 or 15 years. That means the average man, sometimes his wife, but sometimes often just the husband, travels literally thousands of miles for a job in another city. These are particularly stressful jobs. They're obviously in industries, usually manufacturing industries, textile industries. Not only are they the pace is killing, but in China, these workers can work 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, and there's no recourse. I mean, again, if you don't like that or aren't willing to do it, you can leave. There's no protection at all. There's one documentary that I would particularly recommend called Bitter Money, Bitter Money, and it's somewhat of a takeoff on a famous Italian migratory film called Bitter Rice, about women migrant workers in post-war Italy. Bitter Money deals with these families who have had to move to the industrial sites. They occupy one-room apartments for all three, four, five of them. The work hours are killing. They can barely make enough money to survive. They certainly can't make enough money to leave. And it really is an amazing film. It's by a director who, like Ken Loach, is known for his films investigating the industrial precariat as well as the workers that I talked about with Bitter Money. His name is Wang Bing, W-A-N-G-B-I-N-G.
Great, thanks. So the other thing, that a theme that came up in your book that I think I hadn't expected is writing about people, some of whom are living and working like right on the edges of, you know, trash piles and dumps, but also dealing with epidemics and environmental disasters. So you're talking about all kinds of ways that environment connects with precarious work and how the precariat is especially likely to be affected by that. Can you tell us a little bit about those films? What are we seeing in films that are taking us to that part of the world and that part of workers' experiences?
Well, every author likes to think that he's doing something different than all his predecessors. And in this case, I feel that I've developed a couple of categories which have been ignored in many film studies. One of them is what I call the recycle or garbage city film. And the other is what other people, not myself, but I use it, called epidemic cinema. To start with the garbage and recycling, although I'll give you one example in New York City, most of the films concern the third world, as it's loosely called, in which people who scour the streets of the city for recyclables, plastic or whatever, and bring them to a central recycling center or garbage depot, trying to make a few pennies. But this has become so dominant in the culture of these cities that people begin to live on the garbage sites as well, not just come to it to do the work, but actually build a shanty town in the garbage city. And there are remarkable places in a number of cities. I'm looking for a title that might be a really good place to start. Garbage Dreams, set in Latin America. Plastic China. Until recently, container ships that brought finished products to the United States returned to China filled with our plastic waste. They were taken to little home factories, boiled, transformed into something else. These were cottage industries of plastic. And this one documentary is especially good for that. It's called Plastic China. The other one I mentioned is Garbage Dreams. These are hard to believe until you see them in the film. But until recently, there was one in New York City next to Shea Stadium where the Mets play. It's called Willets Point. W-I-L-L-E-T-S, Willets Point. It's an unincorporated slum, if that's the word, or really just automobile workshops, parts, and so forth. It's been in use for decades. The city doesn't maintain the streets. There's no water supply. There's no garbage pickup. There's no sewer. And it's hard to believe that this is in New York City, but if you look at any of the documentaries, most of which you can find by just putting Willets Point in the search engine, and you come up with three or four titles of documentaries about this remarkable place in the United States. We expect these places not to be in the United States, and Willets Point is obviously a rare exception. Perhaps we're more likely to expect them in a place like Cairo, in which I have a number of films about a caste, C-A-S-T-E, of workers who operate the recycling and garbage system in Cairo. They're called the Zabalin, Z-A-B-B-A-L-E-E-N. And there are quite a few documentaries about their unique status in Cairo, because they're not Muslims, and therefore they keep pigs, and the pigs devour the garbage, and they serve as a recycling system for garbage, and then they also treat the other kind of recycling. So there are just some examples of what I call the garbage cities or the recycling cities around the world.
So what about the epidemic films?
Well, I've always been a fan of extreme science fiction and survival films. But as I came to write this book, I realized more and more that epidemic cinema really is a category that also applies to the precariat, because the usual victims in these films almost always are poor and working people. In many cases, all over the world, flu and other outbreaks, viral diseases strike the poor first. They've had no health care to speak of, and they certainly have no access to health care when they get one of these terrible diseases. The most recent one that I would cite as a must-see for American audiences deals with a heat wave epidemic in Chicago in the 1990s, when more than 700 elderly African-American people died from extreme heat in their closed-up apartments. It was a terrible heat wave. In many cases, they were afraid to open the windows to their apartments because they were worried about robbery. They were very isolated. In almost all cases, they were either poor, unemployed, members of the precariat. The title of the film is called Cooked, : Survival by Zip Code. Film done by Judith Helfand, H-E-L-F-A-N-D, who's done quite a few social activist films. But this one is a particularly amazing one because she argues that heat wave and weather-associated phenomenon are also kind of epidemics because they spread, and usually the authorities deny that anything's happening and come too late to try to solve it.
So you said a minute ago in talking about these kinds of films, and especially about the epidemic films, that you're a fan of sci-fi. And I was struck in the book about that as you start thinking about how filmmakers are imagining the precarity of the future and how they're thinking especially about automation, so much of that takes the form of science fiction. So what does that look like? What are those films like?
Well, what's fascinating is that there have been some films, sometimes they involve aliens, sometimes not, in which an American company or space voyage heads out to imaginary, to the film, a real planet in which the alternative species of that planet have been literally enslaved to work in the mines to develop in the same pattern that miners all over the world, they're kept in terribly exploitative situations. But the particular thing that they're mining is gathered and sent back to America on spaceships. Enemy Mine comes to mind as one of the early and probably one of the best films like this, in which it takes an incredibly unlikely situation and convinces you as you watch the film.
Let me ask you about a recent one that I suspect a lot of people listening will have seen. What about a film like Sorry to Bother You that takes, you know, certain forms of precarious work and then melds it to a kind of sci-fi horror-ish way of thinking about things? Are there things that more imaginary, speculative way of approaching this kind of work can help us see?
Yes, yes. I think this is the bending of genre. Sorry to Bother You is a good example. The bending of traditional genres, which I believe that science fiction and utopian fiction films had already done, but now it's starting to get into more socially relevant situations, less science fiction and more kind of underground protest of these conditions. Sorry to Bother You is probably a good example. This, I think, will continue. I mean, the filmmakers that are coming up through the ranks now don't like to be limited to a specific genre, as perhaps some of the older pros were.
So we're just seeing more variation come about over time. Well, speaking of variation, you do something in this book that I haven't seen you do before, which is talk about video games. What inspired you to do that?
Well, I guess I read an article in the newspaper about a video game with the wonderful title Kentucky Route Zero. And having spent most of my life in Kentucky, I was intrigued by the title and read more and played the game. And it's not something I would usually do at all. Kentucky Route Zero takes a number of precariat workers and leads them through what we would call an imaginary journey through the coal mines, Mammoth Cave, other Kentucky features on what we call an adventure quest. The lead character is actually a delivery man, and a typical moment in the video game, and mind you, you're choosing alternative paths and so forth. As a player, there are things to do. I'm describing it now more as a film. You follow this this driver, this delivery man, as he makes a choice to take a shortcut through a mine. And as he takes this road and leads him through a mine, he sees ghosts. And these are the ghosts of miners who have died in disasters of the past. So I just was totally intrigued. The way I described it could be an interesting fiction film, but it's done through the usual mechanisms of gaming, which is that the player makes choices, has to live with the choice, takes different paths and so forth. And Kentucky Route Zero was generally regarded as one of the most intriguing games when it came out 3 or 4 years ago. And as I did more research about it, it turns out that the game makers were film obsessed. They really wanted to give a cinematic feel to their game. And to me, games up to that point had been shoot 'em ups. I had no sense of, quote, cinematography. But as I began to explore these games, it turned out that quite a few of the game makers were heavily influenced and tried to imitate favorite films or favorite film style in the construction of the game. I ended up with about 20 games, and it turned out there were games set in McDonald's, there were games that were set in offices, and the characters would confront other workers or other situations and try to solve them in the best way that the game would allow them to do it. But they were as if they were mini films. In fact, I came across one which I had never heard of until I started this exploration called Fort McMoney. wonderful title. And it's based on Fort McMurray in Canada, which is a fracking and tar sands paradise for big companies. And what the filmmakers did is they went to the town itself and interviewed people who lived, worked there, and took those experiences back into their game, so to speak, so that when you're, quote, playing the game, you're actually interacting with real people who have experienced these things in Fort McMurray. It's just a very unusual kind of angle.
So I think this discussion of the games is really fascinating and partially just how it reflects, you know, the changes in how people who want to tell stories are telling those stories. You said that you had looked at about 20 games, and I don't know if you have any sense how common within the realm of video games these days is attention to work and labor and economic conditions. Do these 20 represent, you know, a tiny slice of everything that's out there, or is this a trend?
I would say it's a relatively tiny slice. I have, gaming is essentially competing with Hollywood in terms of GNP. I mean, there's no way to compare my 20 with probably the mass of video games. What I found, however, was that the video game makers had done other what we might call traditional video games. Shoot 'em ups, adventures, but we're moved to try something a little bit different, and that's how I came up with my list of 20. I think to a certain extent the video game makers are like all of us. They read a newspaper, they see a new show, and they say, "Huh, what about a video game about a person on a border?" So there's one called Papers, Please, and it's about a border control station in which the players have to try to get across the border by various means, and they're going to be interrogated, they're going to be photographed, and so forth as they attempt to cross a border. And it seemed to me that's a good example of real life situations being transformed into a video game with a kind of social or political message.
Well, so that's a great segue into what is really my last question for you, which is about how these films and the games might connect with not just understanding the precariat, but out to activism and perhaps labor activism in particular. And so that's a kind of broad question I'm asking, I think, in part, do you see within the film's attention to activism in response to these working conditions? And do you have any sense that these films and games could be useful as tools for organizing?
Yes, I think I wouldn't be the first one to have the hope that these films might reach people at all levels of the working society to see how things do not have to remain the same, that there have been attempts to change. It's not easy to change. The struggles, both historic and contemporary, are difficult. My favorite example, of course, is 9 to 5. Now, 9 to 5 was a group of women office workers who organized in the 60s. Dolly Parton and made a spectacular film about them. But Julie Reichert, who makes very politically committed films usually, has been working on and is due to release, it's not released yet, a film that has the title Raises, Not Roses, The Story of 9 to 5. So this is a film that not only does a historical investigation of women organizing on their job places, but also says this is a continuing thing. This hasn't gone away just because it happened in the 60s. We still need to look at women's jobs, but jobs in general, and see where the organizing has to be done.
That's great. So, Tom Zaniello, I want to thank you for taking some time to talk to me, give us a little bit of a viewing list. I think we're leaving people with a bunch of ideas of things that they should go see. I also want to make sure they know that there's something they should read coming out soon. The Cinema of the Precariat is due out in February 2020. And if you want to hear more about the films that Tom talks about, just understand more about how film can help you see what you couldn't otherwise see about precarious labor, this is the book to check out. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Hi, this is Lane Windham of Georgetown University and Will Empower. On November 22nd, 1909, more than 20,000 workers in the New York City shirtwaist industry went on strike, mostly young women in their teens and early 20s. It was called the Uprising of 20,000, and it was the largest strike by women to date in American history. 339 shirtwaist firms signed a contract after the 11-week strike. One company did not, the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, which, of course, was the site of the famous Triangle Shirtwaist fire in 1911.
October was LGBTQ History Month, and for this week's Cool Things from the Meany Archive, Chloe Daniel digs into the archive's Pride at Work collection and comes up with a 100-page pamphlet on organizing for lesbian and gay rights and unions.
Hello, everyone. So we're here with another segment of Cool Things in the Meany Archives. I'm the archive specialist, Alan Weirdak, here with our student assistant, Chloe Daniel. And this episode, actually, I'm going to let Chloe do most of the talking. Chloe found this really interesting pamphlet in our Pride at Work collection, basically about organizing for lesbian and gay rights in unions. So, this comes from our Pride at Work collection. So, first of all, Chloe, how did you find this? Like, what kind of work are you doing around the Pride at Work collection that has you so close with the materials?
So, I'm going to be processing this collection soon, within the year. So I've just kind of been, like, getting myself familiar with some of the stuff in there. And one day, towards the end of the day, Alan wasn't at work, and I was kind of bored. So I thought I might try to pull something for LGBT History Month, which is in October.
Yes.
And actually, in the first box, I found this, and I thought that it would be a good podcast. So it's called Pride at Work, and it's a like, ooh, it's a pretty thick pamphlet.
Yeah, how many pages is that thing?
This is like 100 pages. So it's
100 pages?
But it's kind of bound like a pamphlet. Mm-hmm. It's written by someone named Miriam Frank and Desma Holcomb, and they are the main founders of the Lesbian and Gay Labor Network of New York,
okay,
which was founded in 1987. So their main kind of issues that they took up were domestic partnership and kind of research and resources distributed to people with AIDS. So that's kind of the main things that were on the table in the 80s, I guess.
Now, were they union members? Were you able to determine that at all? Like which unions they were members of?
But you know what? I'm honestly not sure which union they are affiliated with, but I know that their collections are at the New York University.
Okay.
But yeah. So this book says it was available for $5 for this copy, or you could get them in bulk. So it's got a pretty interesting introduction. So it kind of starts out talking about the 1987 March for Gay Rights in D.C. So this is when the AIDS Memorial Quilt was revealed for the first time. So what that was basically a big quilt, and each panel was created by friends and family of someone who died of AIDS, and it said their names. And at this point, when it was displayed, it was like, 8,288 names, but today it is over 48,000. And there's an archive of all of them. There are kind of lots of projects actually surrounding them, adding kind of oral histories, biographies of different people. So you can see every single panel of this quilt online if you desire to. And it's pretty neat. I suggest looking it up.
Do you have like for our audience, do you have a sort of like a Google search term or anything that they can use to find this quilt?
Yes, just Google AIDS Memorial Quilts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet.
It's an ongoing project too. So it's got this introduction is really pretty interesting. It's talking about this march, and it's got it talks a little bit about the AFL-CIO reception before this march, which was pretty well attended actually. So the authors of this were kind of surprised that a lot of people, regular kind of union people, many of whom were straight, came out to meet their like gay comrades basically. And the next day was the march. So these union organizers, Desma Holcomb and Miriam Frank, talked to a lot of people.
What do you mean by a lot of people?
Like, they've got a quote. They were out on the streets pretty much. They had a banner that said Gay Pride at Work. And so a quote, "The streets were thronged with other marchers cheering us along. We yelled out to the crowds, 'Are you a union member?' 'Yeah,' we heard. 'What union?' we asked back. And the replies were numerous. 'Teamsters, Local 22, ask me, look, here's my card. Equity, Local 4, teachers, carpenters, Local 124, gays and lesbians in the labor movement. We are everywhere.'" So next it kind of goes into talking about this march. It says there were 500,000 people there, and Cesar Chavez actually gave a speech, and he kind of made a connection between the struggle for justice more broadly and, you know, within the labor movement and LGBT rights.
Do you have any direct quotes from Mr. Chavez's speech?
Besides Viva la Causa, no.
Oh, all right, well.
But I'm sure it's online somewhere. In fact, it might be in the Pride of Work collection. So okay. if you're interested in doing research, that'll be available to you sometime in the near future. The authors were able to talk to some SEIU members from San Francisco who came to this march, because people traveled from all over the U.S. to see this memorial quilt because it was a really big deal, honestly. So they talked to some SEIU members who actually had made panels for this and were very involved in the struggle there for like justice for AIDS, people with AIDS, as well as like for themselves and for their own rights. I've got a quote. A good quote that I think kind of demonstrates the importance of incorporating struggles for LGBT rights into the struggle for workers' rights more broadly. So it says, "As activists, we have something special to offer the labor movement. Organizing skills developed in the lesbian and gay community can be effectively transferred to union work. We can commit fresh energy to solving ordinary problems in organizing our shops and keeping our contracts strong." So I think that's pretty neat. It's like an interesting argument to the labor movement more broadly to kind of include their struggles.
Yeah, broad-based solidarity, absolutely.
Yeah. So it kind of goes into really kind of quite specific on how to organize around specific issues, such as mostly focusing on domestic partnership and kind of rights for people with AIDS and like education surrounding that. It's interesting to think about today. These are not really the issues that are kind of on the table anymore. This book doesn't really mention trans people at all. And that's kind of time and time again, kind of showing to be like what's neglected most, but also what's most important, most pressing to a lot of communities, especially in the DC area, I would say. But yeah, this is really, really interesting. I think it's got a lot of interesting insight into specific, some of the first kind of headways into like specific protections for LGBT people in the labor movement. Yeah, like with teachers on my mind, they're striking in Chicago currently, obviously. Talks a little bit about the Gay Teachers Association.
Okay.
In, where was this? 1977. I think San Francisco as well. So basically, they were able to get like a formal committee within their union, which allowed them to get a specific section in their newspaper or their newsletter for LGBT rights. And this was like the first time this had happened, basically. So it was integrated with all the other kind of struggles that they were talking about, all the other cultural news and everything. And they kind of modeled this practice off of like previous struggles to get like a specific women's section or Black workers section, which I thought was interesting.
Now, when you talk about previous struggles, do they provide any examples of like pre-existing labor struggles that they use as an influence or inspiration?
You know what? I'm sure they do. They say this specific pamphlet, the research they did for it draws from a lot of different contracts that had specific kind of clauses for these different protections.
Okay.
So it's kind of like an amalgamated, like lots of different practices from different unions that okay. They try to build to create like a big strategy that will maybe work across different unions and locals.
Okay. Oh. And I guess the one thing that I definitely am wondering, looking through this pamphlet is considering all of these gender-based discrimination cases that are going before the Supreme Court, if there's anything in this pamphlet that kind of can inform, you know, those struggles going into the future, should some of these protections be eradicated by the Supreme Court, unfortunately, very conservative Supreme Court. Is there anything you found in this pamphlet that can kind of inform the struggle moving forward? I mean, I know you mentioned that this pamphlet seems like it's a little bit dated in several ways, that the fact that it doesn't really mention the trans community or anything like that. But is there anything that, you know, you found that can inform the struggle moving forward?
Definitely. I can't speak to like legislative strategies specifically, but I think they have some interesting insight onto within the local unions, how to draw attention to specific struggles, how to reach out to communities, how to build around those issues, which I think are kind of timeless and important lessons we can learn.
For sure. And then one thing that maybe if you want to add is when you were talking about processing the Pride at Work collection, for our audience who may not necessarily know what it is that archivists do or what we really do here besides pull cool things from our collections and talk about them, what exactly does the reprocessing of Pride at Work entail? Like what are you doing with this collection?
So the box that I pulled this from had a variety of different sizes and shapes of folders. Some were kind of like, you know, manila folders. Sometimes they were like folders with slots that you would probably use for school. Sometimes they were like more like accordion folders. This actually was not in a folder at all. It was just placed towards the back of the box.
Okay.
No like label, tag, anything. So
what are we going to do with it now that once we found it unfoldered? Are we going to folder it? Are we going to rehouse it, reorganize it? What?
A little bit of reorganizing, definitely. Okay. There's not really any series, so things aren't organized. In one box, you might find photographs, meeting minutes, as well as like Time magazine. It's pretty random, and it's kind of hard to navigate. So we're gonna do some create some series. So hopefully, it will be easier for researchers to use. But also, things need to be refoldered because sometimes even the folders like are missing labels, they've fallen off. Just it needs a little bit of love.
Yeah, I was a little TLC. So there's a little bit of a window into what we do here at the Media Labor Archives. Is there anything that you would like to add regarding this pamphlet or the work on Pride at Work or Anything more broadly?
I would just say, if you're interested in getting a little bit more familiar with what Pride at Work does, or maybe just, I don't know, doing some research, it'll be available to you sometime in the future.
Sometime in the future. All right. Well, we don't have a more detailed time frame, unfortunately, but sometime in the future for anyone who's interested. Pride at Work is available now. It's just available in a more piecemeal situation as it undergoes reprocessing, essentially. So this has been another segment of Cool Things in the Media Archives. I'm the archive specialist, Alan Weirdak, here with our student assistant, Chloe Daniel, and until next time.
You tell me get a job, okay, where's the job? You got some nerve, sir, somewhere with all. White the graffiti kids is trying to mark the spot. You don't think we'd rather have a pension and a parking spot? You don't understand, you must be in the dark a lot. I can't even get an interview at Target, dog. You the people, stand up. We the people, put your hands up. Unless you in handcuffs, I wanna see you amped up. We the people, keep them hands up. You the people, stand up. We the people.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. Today's music was Precarious Work by Muhammad Ali. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Scarlock. Thanks for listening. Keep making history, and see you next time.
Is the clothing sell itself, putting dollars in their pockets? No. Does the cash register the profits? Oh, you the people, stand up. We the people, put your hands up. Unless you in handcuffs, I wanna see you amped up. We the people, keep them hands up. You the people, stand up. We the people, put your hands up. Unless you in handcuffs, I wanna see you amped up. We the people, keep them hands up.